Welcome to another edition of Mormonland. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce. I'm here again with our senior religion reporter, Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
Well, we, along with the world, watched in horror this week as Notre Dame burned. Now, with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints poised to announce Friday the details of a massive renovation project for its iconic Salt Lake Temple, perhaps Mormonism's Notre Dame, or at least St. Peter's, thoughts turn to Mormonism's historic structures. To help with that discussion is Alan Roberts, a Utah architect who specializes in historic preservation, including work on Latter-day Saint chapels, tabernacles, and temples. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us. So let's just start with the news of the week a little bit. What were your thoughts that went through your mind during the Notre Dame fire?
I watched about 3 hours of coverage of the fire on CNN, and my first thought was how tragic and disastrous this was. But my second thought was, how did it start, and was it preventable? And I know that it was probably an electrical fire. I've heard that the lights were flickering on and off in the building just before the fire. And electrical fires are commonly a cause of such disasters. But in my mind, they are preventable, and we can talk about that.
Yeah. So have you been to Notre Dame?
I have a couple of times, mm-hmm. inside, outside, taken lots of photos, studied it, yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, when obviously there's an investigation underway, and it does appear to have been related, it sounds like immediately to, at least in the immediate aftermath, to have been caused by the son of the renovation work, you know, because that brings that introduces new dangers, right, when you do renovation and things like that, right?
Well, the scaffolding that I saw in the photos, the live coverage, it looked like there was a lot of wood scaffolding, and I wondered about that too, because we have metal scaffolding, which doesn't burn, and apparently the fire started in the roof area, maybe under the spire, which, by the way, was added to the building much later. The spire was added about the year that the Mormon pioneers came to Utah, 1847, and several of the other parts of the building were added. But anyway, construction can cause problems. We did a building in Medford, Oregon, a hotel, and the week before it was finished to be dedicated, the plumber and his son were welding down in the basement and started a little fire. And they put it out, they thought. But over the weekend, it started up again, and it burned the building to the ground, a six-story building. So we got to design not only the renovation of the original building, but the reconstruction of the new building. Yeah. That's not the way you want to go.
No, it's definitely not. So let me ask you, these are thoughts from afar, and you're not over there looking at the damage and all that and seeing, but what are your thoughts about restoring it? Like, would you replace the steeple? What are some immediate thoughts you might have?
Well, Macron said that they would be fully restored within five years, but a lot of experts have now come forward saying it's more like decades. And you have, in that case, the building itself, and then you have all the artwork, glasswork, artifacts, furnishings, all the stuff in the building. Fortunately, there was a man named Talon, who did a laser imaging scanning program for the building, and he scanned the inside and outside in great, great detail. So they have imagery of everything inside the building and everything outside. So that's going to be an invaluable tool. I don't know if they've done that with the Salt Lake Temple or not, but it's a good idea to document what's there so that if you do lose it, you can recapture it somehow. I think it'll take a long time. It'll involve the best minds of architects, engineers, craftsmen, specialists of all kinds to bring that building back. And you'll never bring it entirely back. You've lost original fabric. But hopefully, in the reconstruction, they can actually improve upon elements of the building. We've encountered, the Brigham City Tabernacle was a project I worked on in 1983. That building burned down in 1896, and when they rebuilt it, the walls were intact and the tower, just like in this case with Notre Dame. But they were able to improve the floor plan. They reversed where the rostrum area and the organ loft was. They flipped it to the other side of the building. They did a better job of engineering to make the building safer. So sometimes a disaster like this can be converted into a benefit to the building.
What do you think about the Provo Tabernacle fire?
Terrible event. That's an interesting story because that had a tower in the middle of the roof originally, and then it was caving the roof in, and they were going to tear it down. But the stake president happened to be Fred Markham, an architect, who came up with an idea for removing the tower and restructuring the roof to save the building. But that fire was apparently an electrical fire, and there was some human error involved. Apparently, one of the people maintaining the building did something that reminds me of the fire in the Kearns Mansion, where it was a Christmas tree fire, and they overloaded the plugs and burned down the interior of the Kearns Mansion. So sometimes human error is a factor, not just so-called natural causes, but the church went to extraordinary effort to save the tabernacle. They could have easily justified just tearing the rest of it down, but they lifted it up, they put it on blocks, they built the structure under it, then they put it back down, then they renovated the inside, made a temple out of it, similar to saving the Vernal Tabernacle, making that a temple. So I have to give the church leaders a lot of credit because there was a great cost and effort involved in saving the Provo Tabernacle.
So on Friday, they'll be announcing the closure of the Salt Lake Temple. It's iconic, as Dave said. What are your thoughts? Do you have any worries about that? The church is also closing its what it's calling its pioneer temples. You're in preservation. What do you?
Our firm, CRSA, my former firm, I'm retired now, but still doing work with the firm. They're involved in several of those temples: Logan, St. George, Washington D.C.
They're not doing Manti, are they?
I think we may be working on Manti as well.
All right.
So those are the earliest temples. And by the way, St. George was the first temple completed in Utah, 1877, and lightning struck the tower, the cupola of that building. Now, Brigham Young never liked that cupola. It was short and squatty. Truman Angel designed something he didn't like, but he died before it was changed. And William Folsom, who was architect for it later, commented Brigham Young would have been happy that the lightning destroyed it because they put a
best. So that's a real story. It's not apocryphal.
It's not. Okay. So they redid the tower with a nice New England, tall, well-proportioned steeple tower to replace the squatty one. So
if Brigham could see it now.
Folsom thought it was divine intervention, basically. So not all fires are bad. I am not concerned about Salt Lake Temple's safety. The reasons are that church, I've been working with church architects on a number of projects, and right now they're very, very good stewards of these buildings. They care deeply. They have the technology. They have the manpower, the expertise, the money to do the right thing. And I think that FFKR, if I'm not mistaken, they're the architectural firm to be working on that project.
Did they work on the Provo Temple also?
Yes. We actually competed for Salt Lake and didn't get it, but the church likes to spread the work around amongst the architects and contractors. But the technology exists to put in place all the kinds of protections that are needed to stop or to prevent something happening to Salt Lake Temple that happened in Notre Dame. You have to think, as architects do and engineers, as to what forces act upon a building to bring about its vulnerability, its demolition. And there are a lot of them. I actually made a list of them. You have fires, earthquakes, water, live and dead loads, poor construction, a lack of detection and monitoring systems, demolition by neglect, which is basically a lack of maintenance, which then justifies tearing it down because it's unsafe or unrenovatable. And the last one is the lack of a preservation ethos, the lack of will to save the building. And I think in this case, Salt Lake, anything on Temple Square, the Assembly Hall, the Tabernacle, any of the buildings, the church will go to the greatest length to make sure those buildings are properly and accurately and safely renovated, restored. I have no doubt that they will do everything in their power to make sure nothing like Notre Dame happens there.
They've done previous work on the Salt Lake Temple, and haven't they done some earthquake? You mentioned earthquakes, and that's, of course, a danger here. They've done earthquake retrofitting or whatever you do on the Salt Lake Temple previously, haven't they?
I don't know about that For the temple. I know they've done that for the assembly hall and the and tabernacle. And all of these buildings are what we call non-reinforced masonry construction. Notre Dame was saved in part because it's a big stone building, but the roof system was wood and some of the spire. The same thing with Salt Lake, who have walls that are 12 and 8 and 6 feet thick of granite. And you'd think, well, it's fireproof. But what about the floor system and roof system? There is wood as well. And there are monitoring systems. There are fire alarms, smoke alarms, rate of rise, heat detection systems. And I think that you can exercise preventative care and putting those monitoring systems into place. That would take the worry factor down. In terms of a construction crew, however, coming in and not adhering to safety standards, that's probably what happened at Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. And it certainly happened in that hotel I mentioned. So they have standards too, however, and those standards are very high now, very demanding. So I'm sure the church will do everything in its power to prevent a disaster from happening there now or anytime in the future.
You said you're not worried about the structure of it being preserved because they care a lot about that. What about the historic character of these temples? Are you worried about that?
That's another issue altogether.
About the ethos.
And it's an issue with Notre Dame. It's an issue with any of these buildings. You want to preserve the character defining features of any historic building. That's what makes it valid as a piece of history. And so if you replace all the original fabric with all new materiality, then you've lost some of that. So you try to, our philosophy and the philosophy of the National Park Service, which maintains the National Register of Historic Places, the philosophy is to retain as many of the character-defining elements as possible. So that's the architectural ornament, the actual material. But sometimes you need to improve on those for safety reasons. We did the Capitol Hill Ward, which is up across the street from the Capitol, mm-hmm. and we did a seismic upgrade of that building. And to save the exterior walls and the interior walls and all the trim, the moldings and ornamental glass and everything, the plaster ornament, we introduced a unique method called wall coring, where you drill vertical holes in the exterior walls and you put rebar, reinforcing bar, in those and polyester resin, and it stabilizes those tall walls without having to put pneumatically applied concrete or gunite on the inside, which would ruin the interior finishes. So what I'm saying is there are favorable and unfavorable ways of doing a renovation that keeps the character of the building. And so when you say, am I concerned? There have been historic structures reports done on the temples by Josh Probert and others, basically documenting all the important architectural features with the intent to preserve those as much as possible. We also have the benefit in Utah of old world craftsmen. We have really high level craftsmanship here, and we have ICAA, the Institute of Classical Art and Architecture, which started out as the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, then went to New York, then went to Salt Lake. And now we have it here and in Utah County, and a lot of the architects like myself have actually been trained by them to deal with preservation of these character-defining elements. So I'm not too worried about that either. But typically, in the main rooms that are accessible to the public, you try to preserve everything possible. But in rooms like kitchens, bathrooms, mechanical rooms, those are places where you want to make sure you have the most modern, up-to-date technology and safety features. And so you make compromises, but not in the public area so much.
They took out the pews out of the tabernacle, which is one of my huge pet peeves.
Right. I understand. And the pews were made of pine, and they were hand-grained to look like...
Exactly. Oh. And they were famous.
They were famous.
Uncomfortable, but famous.
And uncomfortable. So
but
so somebody had to...
spaces between them and kept the...
They were too close together. I know when I went in there, like, to sing the Messiah or something, my knees would be up against the back of the pews.
Maybe for you, but maybe not for Peggy and me.
Yeah, no, exactly. No,
and they weren't comfortable. So someone made a call... and made a decision that comfort and safety were more important than the visual quality of the original pews. I think if I had to make that decision, I probably would have just taken out a few rows.
Exactly.
Increased the spacing, improved the carpeting for sound acoustic reasons, and kept them, or at least kept some of them, kept some section of them.
I'm dying to know where those pews are.
I don't know. And
they're with the Huberman Arch from the Olympics.
But I have to say,
<They're>
I got into preservation in the early 70s when the Colville Tabernacle was torn down. That actually launched me into my career as a preservation architect.
Tell our listeners about that a little bit.
Well, the Colville Tabernacle was built right after the Salt Lake Assembly Hall and designed by the same architect, Obed Taylor. And Thomas Allen in Colville was the local architect. It was an incredible, flamboyant Gothic building, brick, stone, stained glass. There were oil paintings of all the temples on the ceiling of the chapel. It had this very tall, vaulted chapel or sanctuary, organ loft, extraordinary piece of architecture. But in the 1940s, they needed more space, so they put a floor. They just cut the chapel in half and put a floor across it, so vertically it was only half as high. That was unfortunate because then around 1970, when they decided they wanted a new stake center, they used that as the excuse for tearing down the tabernacle. And it was torn down in the middle of the night. I was at BYU at the time, and the head of our department, Milo Boffman, organized a picket or a protest of students. He was going to bus us all to Colville and have us hold up signs and, you know, indicate our displeasure. And the BYU administration got wind of it, and they fired Boffman, fired the entire staff, and did away with the entire department. So, which I thought was an extreme overreaction. And so out of 150 students that were in the environmental design department and architectural degree department, only four of us, I think, ever became architects. And I had to go to the U and work extra years to become an architect. But anyway, it got me thinking, if that building is disposable, if it's not worth keeping, that either we have so many of those that this isn't a great loss, or there's something wrong with the system, and maybe it was a mistake. So I got into preservation of Mormon architecture, and that became the beginning of my career.
Has the LDS Church, you would see that Colville, of course, raising of the Colville Tabernacle as a step backward. Has it improved? Has the ethos in the church improved as far as preserving?
I would say yes, and I would give an example: the comparison of the Logan Temple and how that was treated versus how the Manti Temple was treated. Logan Temple was gutted inside. They took out all the original pulpits and trim and benches and everything. It was just removed and then redone more or less from scratch. That the outrage, and they cut down, I think, 200 original trees that surrounded the building in terms of the landscape. There was such an outcry from people in Logan that it got the attention of church leaders, and they did not do the same with the Manti Temple when they went to renovate that.
What year was this, Alan? When was this in comparison to the Colville? Was it right around the same time?
Yeah, it was. I think it was the mid-70s, late-70s. Mm-hmm. So the Beehive House and Lion House, those were scheduled to be demolished in the 60s, and they were saved. So the DUP, Daughters of Utah Pioneers, were instrumental in that. The Chase Mill was saved as well. But many historic meeting houses and tabernacles were destroyed. I did a survey of Mormon architecture published in 1976. And out of all the tabernacles that were ever built, about half of them are gone, maybe two-thirds. There are still maybe 20 or so left. But now you rarely hear of a really significant historic Mormon church building being destroyed. It doesn't happen very often. They've saved the 10th Ward. They've saved any number of key buildings. They lost the Park First Ward, the prairie-style building that was so significant during that same 70s, 80s period.
Where was that at? That's
in Central City. Like on 8th South, and I think they put a tennis court there or something. But there wasn't a huge outcry, not enough, but a group called Cornerstone started. I was part of that back in the 70s to try to advocate for saving these buildings. And then the late Paul Anderson and I, he and I put together a preservation policy for the church, and we presented it to a group of general authorities. It must have been important because both Paul and I sported beards at the time, and we both shaved our beards off so it would be presentable to the general authorities. And anyway, and they more or less accepted the policy, but we also included with it a list of buildings, and we ranked the existing historic buildings A, B, C, D, with the A buildings being the most significant. And we said the policy should be the more significant the building, the greater the effort to save and properly preserve that building. And they accepted the policy, but not the list exactly, and eventually they came up with their own list. So the answer is unequivocally yes. There's more work being done to preserve these buildings now than in the 70s when I started this, saving the Provo Tabernacle, the Vernal Tabernacle, a number of meeting houses. I've worked on a large number of historic tabernacles and meeting houses that have been preserved. And they could have found justifications to remove them in terms of earthquakes or fire or hazardous materials or building code or lack of elevators to access all the floors, ADA. But instead, they allowed us to work to solve those problems and save those buildings.
Are there some that you're still worried might be torn down, some meeting houses? I know there's been some in my neighborhood in the Harvard-Yale area that have been saved.
Yeah, we worked on the Harvard Ward, and I think there are some, but there are now people employed by the church, Emily Utt being one of them, whose job it is to, as an in-house person, not an external person like myself, and I was involved in helping save the Bountiful Tabernacle, and there's a whole story about how they wanted to tear that down, and Florence Jacobson and I prevailed on President Kimball to save it, and he reversed the decision by the stake presidency and the vote of the stake priesthood to tear it down, and they saved it. And I think that was the beginning of a reversal of appreciation for these buildings. So I think things are better now. Are there still some vulnerable buildings? Probably. I'm not sure which ones. But I think the whole attitude now is different than it was.
Go ahead.
One policy I don't like, I have to say, in all candor, is they now have a policy that if there's a redundant building that they don't need anymore, the policy is to tear the building down and sell the vacant property rather than sell the property with the church still on it. The reason for that was that some churches were sold and then converted into uses that they didn't like. Sort of desacralized the building. And I'm not sure if the 19th Ward might be one of those. I was involved in that. The old historic 19th Ward in Capitol Hill.
Sometimes there are just other churches.
That's where the Salt Lake Acting.
It's Salt Lake Acting Salt Lake Company, Acting. And
yes.
They have Saturday's Voyer in there.
There's one was President Monson's ward, and it is a Buddhist temple.
Yes. If somebody comes and says, I want to make a church of it, like the Logan 6th Ward is another example. It's now another church. That's different. But there was one down in, I think it was Monroe, where they sold the building and it came into possession of a company that repaired cars, and they took the chapel and had the chapel walls lined with hubcaps, and then there was a state liquor depot in the front of it, and that was like the worst possible thing. So I wish they would rethink that policy and allow the buildings to be stockpiled and saved. Great Britain has 10,000 of these so-called redundant churches. They don't tear them down. They keep them until they can find a new use for them that's a compatible use. That's the key, the compatible use.
What are your general impressions of historic Mormon architecture? I mean, how does it rank? How do experts view it? Significant or what?
That's an intriguing question. I'm writing a book right now. It's about 90% done. I'm calling it Brigham's Architects, Utah's Pioneer Architect Builders and Their Works, 1847 to 77, which covers Brigham Young's lifetime here. Mm-hmm. And another book co-authored with Nan Weaver on Richard Kledding, the architect of the Salt Lake, the State Capitol building and many other important buildings. I think that most architecture anywhere is derivative, and it's true here too. For the first many years, we did Greek Revival architecture here, and the Mormon converts from New England and Great Britain were familiar with that style, so they built what they knew, and they continued to do so even after it was out of vogue and had been replaced by the Gothic Revival. And then the church got into the Gothic Revival and all the other styles, prairie style. The Cardston, Alberta Temple is Frank Lloyd Wright prairie style, and that was interesting because it won a competition. All the other architects proposed modernized versions of the Salt Lake Temple with spires and Gothic elements. And these two architects in their 20s came up with this very modern proposal to do a Wrightian prairie style building. And it's a stunning building. So I think there is very significant LDS architecture worldwide. I think the 19th century is my favorite time period more so than the mid to late 20th, because that's when they got into standard plans. And standard plans, there was in the mid-1920s, colonial revival L-shaped mm-hmm. and U-shaped alphabet plan, and they were built all over. And then later in the 60s, they got into these international style plans. But I've been working on a project more recently where they're trying to develop temple designs that are compatible with the geographic locations in which they will be built. And so in Pittsburgh, you would have maybe a Romanesque revival or Victorian Gothic revival building. But in New England, you might have a American colonial revival type building. And I worked on the Tijuana Temple, and that's a Spanish colonial building, and we did a lot of research on the architecture of Mexico and Southern California to develop a building that was contextually compatible with that city, rather than just giving them a standard plan that it's one size does not fit all. And so I think they're more sensitive now too about local environments, materials, styles, tastes, and trying to fit in rather than to impose something that's more foreign or alien to the native area.
So I've heard that the church is planning to redo the wedding cake Provo Temple.
Like they did the Ogden Temple.
Did the Ogden Temple. And I have weird mixed feelings about that.
Well, they did that with Ogden. They kept the steel frame.
Do you think it's a good thing to make it all look like?
Well, there are a couple of reasons why you would do that. And one is if the building needs to be bigger and better functionally. In Ogden's case, they kept the steel framework, removed the exterior skin or material of the building, and then built around it a much bigger building. So it has more rooms, square footages, better hallways, and more impressive, important rooms. In Provo's situation, maybe that's the case. That building was the brainchild of Imo Fetzer, who's, I remember him saying he was on an airplane and the design came to him. But a lot of people have never liked it.
Exactly.
And
I've heard it
called Las Vegas Revival and some or Village Inn Revival. I've heard some very uncomplimentary terms. But architecture is a very subjective thing. It's an opinion more than a set of absolute aesthetic standards. So whether it's significant compared to worldwide architecture, you'll have differing opinions. A lot of the early temples are very eclectic. Kirtland Temple was a mix of styles. Federal, Roman, Gothic. Nauvoo Temple was a mix of styles. Salt Lake Temple is certainly a mix of styles, and so are the other, as you call them, pioneer temples, Manti, mm-hmm. St. George, Logan. Romanesque windows, Gothic buttresses, castellated parapets, sort of Gothic spires, French Second Empire spires in the case of Manti. So eclecticism was our tradition. We were trying to create an architecture that was unique to the institution and not just replicative of some other church style somewhere else. And so not knowing how to come up with something entirely new, what the architects did is grabbed elements from the decorative vocabularies of various styles and mixed them together and blended them, sometimes successfully, sometimes less. I think Manti is very successful. Today, temple architecture is different than meeting house architecture, and you've got to, you know, the standards are much, much higher for one than the other. But even for meeting houses, if you go to Southern California, you'll see the Hollywood Tabernacle. It's a beautiful building that fits into Southern California architecture. And if you go to, say, Arizona, you'll see plaster and red tile. If you go to New England, you'll see brick and stone. The Washington, D.C. Chapel is a wonderful Gothic building done in a modern Gothic style with stone cladding. So I think there's a lot of effort to try to do the right thing, and there's a large staff of administrators, architects, engineers, historians in-house working with the church, but everything gets approved ultimately by the general authorities. And President Nelson is actually driving a lot of these initiatives to have compatible architecture in various locations.
There have been, though, when President Hinckley announced the building of, a lot of new temples, and now some of them have already had to be closed for renovation. Some of the temples that were built in the 2000s, and I was told by a person.
Well, Memphis, for one, is just now. Yeah,
Montreal, mm-hmm. a bunch of them have barely 10, 15 years old, have had to be closed for renovation. And a person in the temple department told me that it was because there was a kind of standard plan for temples, and it was based on Utah climate and did not take into account humidity. So all of these temples had to be closed because there was mold. And
I think there could be different reasons. It could be building code related. It could be related to something like mechanical systems. Those are always tricky. I know when they put in our new library downtown, Moshe Safdie from Israel specified certain stone paving for the outside entry plaza. Within the first year, it had all started crumbling and breaking apart because he had the grain running the wrong way, and it was a sedimentary stone, and he didn't know about our freeze-thaw cycles, apparently, and they spent $1 million in the first year to replace all that paving with a more durable, weather-resistant stone. The church has architects here in-house in Salt Lake, but they also have architects and engineers around the world in other locations. And the idea is that those people understand those codes and those environmental factors. You really shouldn't be remodeling a building after 15 years if it's done right the first time, unless there are functional changes. Let's say that the endowment process, let's say that set of experiences is redesigned, then the rooms, all of the rooms that support that might have to be modified to accommodate the new function of that ordinance.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings a question I think a lot of people are wondering about the Salt Lake Temple renovation. You know, the church is very straightforward about the fact that the endowment you refer to, one of the ordinances in the temple, is portrayed in film in virtually all the temples except a couple, Salt Lake being one of them, I think Manti is the other. A lot of people are a little concerned about that a film will be introduced at the Salt Lake Temple, and that may change how the Salt Lake Temple's renovated.
You're right. It could be. And I don't know. And if I did know, I probably wouldn't be allowed to tell you.
Probably so. But
but no, that's a valid concern. I think traditionalists, blue blood Mormons, especially from around here that have been going to Salt Lake Temple for decades, would love to see the live endowment stay intact, at least mm-hmm. in one place. Mm-hmm. And if every temple changes over to the film version, there'll be some disappointment, I suspect. But other changes are being made to the language, to how women are treated, in relation to their husbands and their relationship to God. And there are lots of progressive things going forth. And those things ultimately can have architectural ramifications. Form follows function, we're told, and there's at least some truth to that.
Yeah. So you brought up the meeting houses, and this is a question I hear a lot from people, especially when they locate here. And in Salt Lake City and Utah, there's a lot of Mormon meeting houses. And they seem fairly utilitarian, I think is the word I hear a lot. What do you think of most of the, I'm not talking about historic ones, but meeting houses that are built, what do you think about that plan and how they're built and how they look? Some people feel like they're not reverential enough.
Well, I think that using Notre Dame as an example, a prime example, and I think Salt Lake Temple is sort of our Notre Dame, so we have to give it the same kind of consideration. Christian architecture has been characterized through the ages by a couple of things. One of them is tall worship spaces with natural light coming in, windows and clerestory windows even higher. The verticality, heavenward reaching, awe-inspiring spaces with natural light. That's probably the main thing, those two things, verticality and natural light. The meeting houses that we have, and notice that you didn't use the word church or edifice or tabernacle or any other ecclesiastical term.
Right.
You said meeting.
Right.
Well, meeting house is a term used in New England for, the Quaker meeting houses and some of the early the 19th century and 18th century religions. They were meeting houses. They weren't thought of as these grand iconic pieces of architecture as, say, the Catholics and Protestants developed in Europe. So I would like to see natural light introduced into the meeting houses. Some of them have no natural light coming into the chapel. Mm-hmm. I designed a chapel in Logan for the USU Third Stake. This was back in like 1986. And it was actually two chapels because it was for a stake of students. And so one chapel faces south, one chapel faces east. But I had natural light and used glass from Germany, Vismach stained glass, vaulted ceiling, wood ceiling, brass, burgundy color scheme, just beautiful building. In fact, one of the general authorities that came to dedicate it complained that it was, quote, too beautiful, and I was astounded
took that
by
as
the
a compliment,
quote.
Right?
Yeah, it wasn't a compliment; it was a criticism. And I think that the roofs are like 200 feet long, unbroken roof. And why couldn't there be an interior courtyard? Why couldn't the plan be broken up a little bit more so it's not just such a monumental building? Why couldn't the styles be more reflective of local designs and materials and be sensitive in a more thoughtful way. But frankly, the church has done a lot of studies and hired lots of architects to try to deal with this challenge. I know our firm once was commissioned to design several new meeting house designs for two-story chapels, chapels on hillsides, chapels with different styles. And those studies didn't really go anywhere, but they continued to analyze this question. But I could see meeting houses being improved in their design. I really do.
Would that add tremendous amount to cost?
Well, that's the factor. They're building so many of them. Last I knew, the church was completing two buildings a day somewhere in the world. Or was it a week? Maybe it was a week. I think it must have been a week.
A lot.
This was decades ago, though, so who knows what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And so The temple designs maybe got out of hand a little bit in the last decade. Some of them were very, very expensive, Payson, and I can name some others. And I think they'd now like to reduce the cost. In fact, I know that. We've been instructed to try to simplify the structure, maybe simplify the family of ornament, not to the point where we compromise the quality of it architecturally. It's a difficult thing to ask. It's like saying, design me a Maserati on a Kia budget. You know, it's hard to do. But most clients ask you to do that, whether it's the church or somebody else. That's a common thing. But that's the, you want a balanced equation. It's got to be functional. It's got to be, meet the standard, aesthetic standard for beauty. It's got to be temple-like. It's got to be cost-effective. In terms of maintenance, it needs to be low maintenance. I think they've experimented with sustainable architecture, too. And I encourage that as well, as long as the initial cost is, it can be amortized over time by the cost savings from having sustainable building. So I think they're aware of all of these things. They're a sophisticated group, but you can only do so much with the money at hand, and so they're always trying to do that balancing act, juggling act.
Alan Roberts, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Peggy, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And special thanks to our producer, Sarah Weber, and we'll talk again next week on Mormonland.